This is Poetry on the Move. In this episode, we interview Singaporean poet Alvin Pung. And we conclude our discussion with Melinda Smith and Karen Florence on collaboration. But first,
thank you for waiting. At this moment in time, we'd like to invite first-class passengers only to board the aircraft. Thank you for waiting. We now extend our invitation to members of our exclusive Superior Excelsior Privilege Association, followed by triple, double and single platinum members, followed by gold and silver card members, followed by pearl and coral club members. Military personnel in uniform may also board at this time. Thank you for waiting. We now invite Bronze Alliance members and passengers enrolled in our Rare Earth Metals Points and Rewards Scheme to come forward, and thank you for waiting. Accredited beautiful people may now board, plus any gentleman carrying a copy of this month's Cigar Aficionado magazine, plus subscribers to our Red Diamond, Black Opal and Blue Garnet schemes. We also welcome Sapphire, Ruby and Emerald members at this time, followed by Amethyst, Onyx, Obsidian, Jet, Soapstone and Quartz members. Priority Lane customers, Fast Track customers, Preferred Access customers, Chosen Elite customers and First Among Equals customers may now also board. On production of a valid receipt, travellers of elegance and style wearing designer and or hand-tailored clothing to a minimum value of $10,000 may now board. Passengers in possession of items of jewellery, including wristwatches with a retail purchase price greater than the median annual salary of a mid-career high school teacher, are also welcome to board. Also welcome at this time are passengers talking loudly into cell phone headsets about recently completed property acquisitions, share deals and aggressive takeovers, plus hedge fund managers with proven track records in the undermining of small to medium-sized ambitions. Passengers in classes loam, chalk, marl and clay may also board. Customers who have purchased our Dignity or Morning Orchid packages may now collect their sanitised shell suits prior to boarding. Thank you for waiting. Mediocre passengers are now invited to board. Followed by passengers lacking business acumen or genuine leadership potential, followed by people of little or no consequence, followed by people operating at a net fiscal loss as people. Those holding tickets for zones rust, mulch, cardboard, puddle and sand might now want to begin gathering their crumbs and tissues ready for boarding. Those passengers either partially or wholly dependent on welfare or kindness, please have their travel coupons validated at the quarantine desk. Sweat, dust, shoddy, scurf, feces, chaff, remnant, ash, pus, sludge, clinker, splinter and soot. All you people are now free to board.
That was Simon Armitage reading at IPSI's 2016 Poetry on the Move Festival, hosted by the University of Canberra, where he was one of the poets in residence. Simon has published over a dozen collections of poetry, including his latest selected poems, Aeroplane. He is Professor of Poetry at the University of Sheffield and was recently appointed to be Professor of Poetry at Oxford University. We'll have more from the Poetry on the Move Festival in coming episodes and a couple of more poems from Simon a little later. Alvin Pung is a Singaporean poet, writer, editor, and translator whose work has been translated into over 15 languages. He appears regularly in major festivals and publications worldwide. Here, Owen Bullock speaks to Alvin about Singapore's recent cultural politics and conservative turn, as well as the collection of Singaporean writing he helped edit, Union. but to begin a poem from Alvin, To Go to Spore.
To go to Spore. Which station for Spore, if not in a dream at dusk when rain glistens on chrome? When mass rapid trains and light rail trains are borne to all corners. To leave in a hurry for Spore, night and day, in August or in May, but early, but only if Spore exists, if it is to be found within the bounds of this island and not just in the color of my passport, of my smart card, if the smell of rain trees after thunderstorm, of Angsana, of frangipani, still lingers like fresh smoke, if the canals brim and grumble like epithets in Hokkien, vanish beneath ground. To pack up and go, to leave and never look back, at 5 p.m., to cease like shop windows, while beneath the whirl of fans in coffee shops, geckos chatter their politics. But the office tower rises straight as the law, and everyone standing in its shadow, and a mop and bucket leaning on window glass, and our dream which hadn't come yet, only concrete and litter bins, and the rainbow pulse of new pups set to music, the low bass tremble of bumboats rocking. Always too much of Spore. No one could fathom the depths of its neighborhoods, walk the inside trails between each block and hear the crease and hiss of each brick speaking, scalded by sun, at night the city's muteness, the dead stillness in Shenton Way, unlike that of temples where monks keep silence full of unseen rivers. In Liangxia Street, history spilt in unlit stairwells and on window louvers swinging and shutting by themselves, in china blue ceramic tiles, in flour, in the smell of eggs, the form of feathers plastering the walls, in green muck collecting in rusty pipes, fronds growing where laundry once sprouted, and the streets played percussion, and the air singed, the procession of the devout sang like kings of the world toward the temple gates. People in such frantic joy, they didn't want to stay indoors. So much life, it burst and flooded every street, it cracked the sky in thunder and fireworks, the new year lived over and over. My grandmother, as she stood at the window, calling for my father, dinner ready and steaming in the evening light, and neighbors shouting from windows, watching out for trouble and the next meal, and nothing tentative as hope. An uncle slaved himself blind, reading by candlelight, while my father was out catching fireflies. The health inspector came, and my grandfather bought him a drink and covered the cockroaches with his soul and got away with it. Even then, there was too much of Spore. It overflowed, each drain came down as rain, so much and yet none. What was there spawned, grew, cut into shape, not without love, and now the green June springs from every square, verdant wigs pulled over everything. Weeds, atta, kampong and 5 foot way fell away as the towers rose, pushing out above the temples. People shuffled on, handbags and wallets full of tomorrow, and every estate growing into each other, and everyone a leaseholder, and now in a hurry to just go, and somewhere to come and go from, Spore tugged every which way, Spore clutched in the small palm of the sea, becoming and flowing in like tears, tides, currents, rivers run beneath the surface, everywhere.
Alvin, wonderful to have you back with us at
Hello,
Poetry
Alan.
On the Move.
Thank you.
You mentioned yesterday in your presentation Everything Also Must Do with your compatriots that Singlish still couldn't be broadcast on radio or television, and yet it can be published? Is that the case?
Well, it's actually an injunction. I mean, we're talking about Singlish or the Singaporean vernacular, which is primarily expressed as an oral language or vernacular patois. So I suppose that's where it counts. There is an injunction against the use of spoken Singlish, which is seen by the establishment as corrupted English, basically, and therefore not conducive to our image as a sort of modern, business-friendly metropolis. There is a Speak Good English movement that's out to essentially encourage people to speak good English, which is in itself, I think, improper English. But there you have it. Mm. And so as part of this drive to sort of get rid of this sort of folksy, corrupt vernacular, it's discouraged like many other vernacular languages in Singapore, it's discouraged from public broadcasts. Mm. Of course, it still creeps in, you know, radio DJs will slip into it. It's become sort of folksy and sexy in a sense to sort of slip that in to sound more local. In terms of publishing, people still do it. It's not necessarily encouraged, but it's not an outright. It won't get you arrested or anything like that, but it's frowned upon.
Mm. And much interest in journals overseas?
In Singlish?
Yeah.
Well, the most prominent exchange about this was there was a piece written by, I think, Dr. Gwee Li Sui, is a compatriot, again, a Singaporean, was published in the New York Times, and he was celebrating Singlish as a very vernacular, very off-the-place, very organic language that at the same time has a special place as a form of political resistance, as it were. Mm-hmm. Not in the explicit ideological sense, but in the sense of being a language from the grassroots, as it were, that is able to take the mickey out of, you know, the powers that be, and how that is, in a sense, part of what makes it thrive, and that's what makes it valuable and powerful. It solicited no less than a response from the Prime Minister's press secretary to a column in the New York Times. So there was a bit of a back and forth about this. And this came on the back of the Oxford English Dictionary absorbing some Singlish words into its canon. And I just heard this morning that a couple more words have been added. So,
nice.
You know, one authority pushing one way, another authority sort of pushing the other.
Mm.
I think that tension is quite creative.
Mm, yeah.
So that's where we stand at the moment. Yeah. There is a lot of interest, obviously, in not just literary journals, but literary communities and non-literary communities. People interested in the politics of language. People interested in how a really quirky place like Singapore is evolving, and how the social forces that often are not visible when you look at Singapore, you very often get the official accounts, which tend to be about the figures. You know, we're number one in this, we're biggest in that, we're richest in this way, most millionaires, so on and so forth. Relatively little is spoken of in terms of the cultural movements. And this is very much a part of it that is just becoming visible.
Mm. I was also intrigued yesterday to hear that that recent collection by Cyril Wong, which had won a major award, couldn't actually be borrowed from a library.
They do that. I mean, there was a famous fracas about 2-3 years back, and I was part of that. Essentially, what happened is there's a neoconservative movement that's coming up. It's religiously motivated. You have essentially very conservative, and not to put too fine a point about it, homophobic churches teaming up with conservative, for example, Islamic groups, so on and so forth. Well, religious people who think that, you know, essentially anything that's outside normative heterosexual relations is sort of bad for society, not to mention immoral and so on. So there's an active movement to sort of go out and get rid of anything that reminds people that alternative sexualities exist. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's, of course, a very strong, healthy and dynamic and growing gay pride movement in Singapore. There's also the third party, which is the state, which has kept Victorian era anti-gay laws, unnatural sex laws, on the books. And they're sort of playing both sides in a sense so that no one voice becomes dominant. But the bottom line is male gay sexual relations are still illegal, although gay culture is not. What happened was our libraries were, for the longest time, progressive institutions that supported a love of reading, and the range of books that they could carry was really remarkably broad. In recent years, however, because of the conservative sort of tide coming in, books that were for years okay and were in the shelves would suddenly be singled out and complained about, and the library has been on the back pedal, basically been obliged to respond. Now, one very famous case is of a book, Entangle Makes Tree, which is a very well-known children's book featuring it's a real life story about two male penguins in a zoo in New York that adopted a baby penguin and they live as a family.
Right.
So it's a real life story. I mean, it's actual non-fiction depicted for kids, but it's also it was taken as a sort of token of legitimizing, you know, sort of male gay relationships. And so someone complained about it. The library decided to pulp the book.
Wow.
It had been on the shelves for 9 years. They decided to pulp the book. So this caused a huge backlash because pulping books is just still in our society seen as something really awful, thank goodness. You know, it's like book burning, really. And so even people who might not have been comfortable with the values were just outright against the idea of pulping books. And there was a lot of back and forth. I was involved in that, and in the end, the minister stepped in, and the compromise was that the books were not pulped. And so it's part of, I guess what I'm trying to say, it's part of an ongoing trend of, you know, sort of filtering out content that content that is arousing discontent or malcontent. I don't think it's healthy. No. I think it's a huge step backwards. And I think it's an invasion of neutral public space by people who have no business determining who gets to talk about what. You know, they're taking over a conversation and a space that has always been about the free flow and movement of ideas.
And how's the critical response been to Union? You published the anthology of Singaporean writing last year. I noticed you had launches in a few different places.
Yes, that was very interesting because we were talking about this, I think, earlier this morning. The responses have been interestingly mixed. So from a popular point of view, I think people enjoy the book and like the book. I've had private conversations. The sort of published critical responses have depended on where they're coming from. The kindest reviews have come from Australia, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. The Australian Literary Review had a lovely, brief but very, very lovely positive review that essentially appreciated what we were trying to do, the diversity we were trying to represent, and enjoying that. So it's almost as if they got what we were trying to do and celebrated that. For the exact same reasons, Hong Kong didn't like it. The critic in Hong Kong criticized the book for precisely the same reasons the Australian critic enjoyed the book, which is that it was diverse, it was mixed. From the Hong Kong, from the South China Morning Post's critic's point of view, it felt unstructured and, you know, sort of too diverse, too mixed, right. Not enough editing.
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting how these things go. The Singaporean newspaper critic was typically dismissive of the fact that it wasn't done by an important academic or professor.
That was Alvin Pung. Union is published by Ethos Books. Alvin's latest book of poems, When the Barbarians Arrive, is by Arc Books. Now some more from Simon Armitage.
An accommodation. And I both agreed that something had to change, but I was still stunned and not a little hurt when I staggered home one evening to find she'd draped a net curtain slap bang down the middle of our home. She said, "I'm over here and you're over there, and from now on, that's how it's going to be." It was a small house, not much more than a single room, which made for one or two practical problems, like the fridge was on my side and the oven was on hers, and she had the bed while I slept fully clothed in the inflatable chair. Also, there was a Husker-Du CD on her half of the border, which I wouldn't have minded hearing again for old time's sake, and her winter coat stayed hanging on the door in my domain. But the net was the net, and we didn't so much as pass a single word through its sacred veil, let alone send a hand crawling beneath it, or, God forbid, yank it aside and go marching across the line. Some nights she'd bring men back, deadbeats, incompatible, not fit to kiss the heel of her shoe. But it couldn't have been easy for her either, watching me mooch about like a ghost, seeing me crashing around in the empty bottles and cans. And there were good times too, sitting side by side on the old settee, the curtain between us, the TV in her sector, but angled towards me, taking me into account. Over the years, the moths moved in, got a taste for the net, so it came to resemble a giant web, like a thing made of actual holes, strung together by fine, nervous threads. But there it remained, and remains to this day, this tattered shroud, this ravaged lace suspended between our lives, keeping us inseparable and betrothed. The christening. I am a sperm whale. I carry up to 2.5 tons of an oil-like balm in my huge coffin-shaped head. I have a brain the size of a basketball, and on that basis alone am entitled to my opinions. I am a sperm whale. When I breathe in, the fluid in my head cools to a dense wax, and I nosedive into the depths. My song, available on audio cassette and compact disc, is a comfort to divorcees, astrologists, and those who have pitched the quavering canvas tent of their thoughts on the rim of the dark crater. The oil in my head is of huge commercial value and has been used by NASA, for even in the galactic emptiness of deep space, it does not freeze. I am attracted to the policies of the Green Party on paper, but once inside the voting booth, my hand is guided by an unseen force. Sometimes I vomit large chunks of ambergris. My brother, Jeff, owns a camping and outdoor clothing shop in the Lake District and is a recreational user of cannabis. Customers who bought books about me also bought Do Whales Have Belly Buttons by Melvin Berger and Street Maps of Cardiff. In many ways, I have seen it all. I keep no pets. Lying motionless on the surface, I am said to be logging and lobtailing when I turn and offer my great slow fluke to the horizon. Don't be taken in by the dolphins and their winning smiles. They are the pickpockets of the ocean, the gypsy children of the open waters, and they are laughing all the way to Atlantis. On the basis of finders keepers, I believe the Elgin Marble should remain the property of the British Crown. I am my own god. Why shouldn't I be? The first people to open me up thought my head was full of sperm, but they were men and had lived without women for many weeks and were far from home. Stuff comes blurting out. And I'm just going to...
In the last episode, we heard from poet Melinda Smith and letterpress artist Karen Florence on their ongoing collaborative ventures. We conclude the interview here with a discussion of their most recent collaboration, Members Only. I began by asking Karen what the project entailed.
It's a parliamentary year, but it's 1962. So we had originally we were going to do a year in the life of Parliament House because we love Old Parliament House after that experience. And so the book will have 12 leaves, I guess it is, 12 signatures of single folds. And each page opening is a month. So it goes from January through to December as a calendar year. And each month has a theme. So January, we went by Hansard. It's uncreative writing. Everything in it is either Hansard or the Canberra Times.
Mm-hmm. Or rearranged signed text or yes, anagrams.
Right. Yeah, so
it's all
sort of
kind
found
of
text.
Predetermined text.
Yeah.
What you get when you search for silence. One of his colleagues has gone into a significant silence. To silence us, but this is having no effect. Listen in silence. spoken and heard in silence. The Prime Minister has observed an unusual silence on this matter. There was an old Australian play written many years ago called The Silence of Dean Maitland. The Honourable Member talked about the silence of Dean Maitland. The silence of Arthur Calwell is the more remarkable aspect of this matter. I received a certain amount of ridicule and a certain amount of scorn by silence. There is a period of awful silence while research is carried out, and the soldier continues out of the silence into which he has preferred to enter. I am also conscious of the silence, that there was silence. That is the answer about the £10,000.
We picked 1962 almost out of a hat. Like there were iconic years we could have done, like 1927 when the building was open.
Yep.
It was 1975, you know. But we sort of picked out the year that Indigenous people got the right to vote. They didn't have to vote, but if they did vote, they had to vote from then on. Yeah. So it was an enfranchisement year. Is that the right
word? Yeah, enfranchisement. And they had to vote kind of. If their state gave them the right to vote, then they could vote. But this is the first time that kind of Commonwealth enfranchised them all across.
Each month has a theme. Yeah. It's actually a really big one on social issues. And 1962 is actually a really cool year because Menzies was in full flight, feeling really established. Yeah. But Gough Whitlam's on the scene. So there's some interesting stuff happening in Hansard. You know, so we managed to get, you know, one of the months we actually have Gough, and every month has an anagram, and September is, you know, the anagram is Gough Whitlam.
And it was the last year of Dry Lake. Canberra's lake started to get filled towards the end of 1963. So 1962 was the last year of that surreal paddock just sitting there with the bridges going over it.
Sports happening on it.
Yeah, sports and, you know, crops growing on it and all sorts of things. Yeah. View of the Molonglo, February 1962. This is progress, ugly and too slow, like life. Picture a little river, banks well-wooded, hay tall in the paddocks, a little road curving through to dip and cross in a hollow down there, squired by spindly grey sticks of weathered telegraph poles. The river has no future, or rather its future is to be subsumed in the idea of a lake. Call it a dormant idea, sleeping these 40 years. The embarrassment of Robert Menzies rouses it. Unleashes the bulldozers at last. There is felling and gouging, moved earth heaped into putative islands named by committee. A grand bridge rises to skim the treetops, 2 years ahead of its shore, soaring over nothing much, swirling with the dust of drought. Next month, Menzies will unlock a chain and send a motorcade across. A line of willows, clinging to a snake of sand, straggles to exit, stage right. Next year, in spring, the valves will close on Scrivener Dam. Still no rain. The lake persisting as an abstraction. There will be billabongs, mosquitoes, acrimony. Months and months of Menzies intoning in his sleep. Trust, my people, trust the waters will come to cover this wilderness we have made.
So there's a lot of nice connections with the nation and
absolutely
the local
socialism. We got a lot
Canberra.
Of like, you know, what sort of secrets and spies.
Oh yeah, the Communist sort of Party stuff.
Yeah.
And and again, it was all about the building, finding the building speaking, because our very first interaction with it was working with the text on the hand-lettered wooden signs.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, prosaic things like, you know, members exit this way and stuff like that. And we rearranged the text of the signs to say things like, use the polished hour. Care for the time between point many to the end. It's this kind of poignant little mortality, you know, memento mori sign. And it's got a one of those old-fashioned pointing hand symbols, which is called a manicule. And
really?
Yes.
Current
so we have anagrams of manicule point too. One of them is a nicotine lump, and another one is mole unit panic.
All sorts of things. And so the idea of using Hansard kind of came out of that same place of let's just find some words that the building has already said or have been said inside the building and rearrange them to, you know, make new art, as it were. Health upon notice. Has the Minister's attention been drawn to a report by the Royal College of Surgeons after investigation, extending over 3 years, that the death rate from lung cancer rises steeply with the increasing consumption of cigarettes, and that heavy cigarette smokers may have 30 times the death rate of non-smokers? What action does the Minister propose to warn the Australian community? The Minister for Health has furnished the following replies. The Royal College of Physicians is a most eminent body. Its opinions have to be given very great weight. The results of their study point to the need for a much greater understanding by our young people of the risks associated with smoking. It would be an excellent thing if adequate instruction were provided in educational institutions, especially high schools, regarding the possible dangers to health resulting from smoking. Properly explained information would enable young people to be well informed regarding the risks involved before they commence smoking.
That was Melinda Smith and Karen Florence. They are working on a book of members only, which will be released in 2017. Before we finish, two more short pieces from Simon Armitage.
So this is a bed. Unmade, mid-morning. A dress where it fell, where you snaked from it. The slab of the bedsheet marbled with creases. These pillows washed up along the strand line. Plunder. Salvage. The end of the world beyond its edge. The patch of grass where we took down the tent. A gift. The gift wrapped disturbed. The present taken. The quilt rolled back, the wave not broken, always breaking, the book left open, the page you were reading. And this is a chair. All on its lonesome, itself solitary, hieroglyph of the detainee. This dining chair, the four bare legs, orphaned foal, turned to the wall. An armchair slumps, exhausted, tired of the weight. This high chair implores to be lifted, held. Compare the sofa or corny settee, the cushioned togetherness, the chummy repose. Then pity the chair, the meal for one, throne of the jilted, after the inquiry, hooded and bound, fully confessed. The policeman takes off his helmet, the consultant closes the door. Yourself only, sit down, a chair. Thank you.
This has been Poetry on the Move. I'd like to thank our guests, Simon Armitage, Alvin Pung, Melinda Smith, and Karen Florence. This podcast is made possible by IPSI, the International Poetry Studies Institute, and the Centre for Creative and Cultural Research, Faculty of Arts and Design at the University of Canberra. Thank you for listening.